All right, let's get started. Today we discuss the first of two lectures on the great seminal Holocaust itself, World War I. We're going to do the first part today and the second part on Wednesday, down to the conclusion of the armistice, and then we'll end on Wednesday, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1918, when the guns indeed fall silent on the Western Front and the war comes to an end. Today we're going to start with the outbreak of the war. But before we do that, I just want to talk, we haven't talked for a while, I want to talk about the Fisher thesis. Who can tell me what it is? It's important that we know what the Fisher thesis is. There are three parts to it. Go ahead. First name, I know your
Margaret.
Name. Margaret. Go ahead, Margaret.
Germany wants a war between Austria and Serbia.
But they were willing to accept a European war with France and Russia and Britain. Go ahead.
No one
pushes Germany into it. It's a choice they made themselves. The Entente, the British, the French, and the Russians were acting defensively. That's point three, in response to what the Germans did. Okay? But Fisher cuts everybody some slack. The Germans feel... Ben and Alicia just asked me, why would the Germans gamble on a war with the Russians and the French? I didn't tell you, because they think they can win it. All right? That's why. Now, Fisher cuts everybody some slack, cuts the Germans some slack. What does he say? Go ahead, tell me your name.
Hunter.
Hunter, go ahead. They feel encircled, that's okay. Whose fault is that? German. Go. Tell me your name.
Gammon,
go ahead. Okay, let's get a little slower. Because of military domination at the Kaiser's court, one, okay? I think we want to say the military are independent of civilian life or from civilian control. I'm sorry, go ahead. Constitution's antiquated. We'll talk about that a little bit today. It's not modern. It's not in any sense of the word. And most of all, that's one. Fishers, remember it that way, because this guy's Fisher, no pun, Fishers in German society, between the militarists and the industrialists, between the naval men and the military men, between the liberals and the conservatives. That's one of the bases of this country's a seething cauldron ready to blow up. And in order to prevent it from blowing up, the leaders gamble on a European war. In the European War, which they're responsible for. Okay, what else about the Fisher thesis? What does it assume? We said the counterfactual. Go ahead, Jonathan.
The economic policy would have dominated even without a war.
Without a war, yeah. But I wanted to get one month. If Germany had not the assumptions, the counterfactual. Go ahead, Kevin Beck. The Germans wouldn't have felt encircled if they not had behaved. They wouldn't have behaved aggressively. What else? They wouldn't have. Go, Alex.
They wouldn't have acted aggressively if they had attempted
social reform. If they had attempted, that's the counterfactual. They wouldn't have. If they had attempted social reform, they wouldn't have had to act aggressively. What follows from that, Jonathan?
Social cracks would have liberalized.
No, well, yeah, to some extent, but a Germany reformed. Go, your name?
Charlie.
Go ahead, Charlie.
A more
liberal Germany would have been more acceptable to the British and the French. All right? That's the Fisher thesis. And Professor Keylor, in his first chapter, has a wonderful exposition of the Fisher thesis, diametrically opposed to my own.
So you can read that and decide, you know, I'm perfectly willing to accept credit. This man published a textbook. I haven't. And then also, there's a devastating critique of the Fisher thesis delivered by Paul Schrader in that last article in The Reader. But that Fisher thesis is something, it may appear, I know that we're getting close, one month, but on the 10th of March, something happens. It's halfway through the course. Guess what that means? It's a wonderful idea on a midterm. The Fisher thesis, if you know anything about the First World War, you're going to sound intelligent. Say the Fisher thesis, okay? It's been around for 50 years. People are still fighting about it, arguing about it. And I mean that is a testament to the importance of the man and his work. I don't mean to demean him. A testament to his work. All right, what does the Fisher students say about Austria? Go ahead, Dan. Austria's desperate. Why are they desperate?
Because they did nothing to fix their nationality.
Tell me your name again. I'll write it.
Gammon.
All right. I only can learn names by, if I write them down, call on you, and just am forced to remember, which I want to do. And you guys don't look anything like your pictures that you take when you first register here. Believe me. You've changed. You've all grown up. All right, Austria's desperate. Why is she desperate? Gammon?
Because they did nothing to fix the nationalities.
Did nothing to heal the nationalities problem. What about this nationalities problem in the monarchy? We said it's insoluble, but it's not fatal. Who makes it fatal? Alvin. Absolutely, the British and the Russians. The British and the Russians acting with another power in the Balkans. Who's that?
Serbia.
Absolutely right. They helped solve the nationalities problem for the Austrians. Other thing, another point to remember about the First World War. If anything, Paul Schrader says this brilliantly, eloquently. If anything is to remember about the First World War, it's this. It is the extinction, the disappearance of a great power from the ranks of the great power. Who's the great power? Austria. Austria is a great power on the ranks of becoming, falling into second place status. Everybody knows this. But no one does anything about it. The British have a responsibility. Yes, what kind of a responsibility? Not to give Austria aid, no. But to hold back their allies, the Russians. What else? What makes the British position important? Where is Britain? What is Britain? An island. Has flexibility. But the other powers do not. It's not tied to the French, as the French and the Russians are, to an alliance. The alliances, Britain makes alliances. Who these alliances, 1904 and 1907? What are the 1904 alliances with whom? The 1907 alliances with?
Russia.
What the effect of those alliances is to drive what two powers forward in Europe? They say they're directed against Germany. They wouldn't have happened had it not been for German pressure. No. They're natural in and of themselves because Britain has interest. What's the British interest? No. The British have an interest. What area of the world are they interested in? A part of it. Empire. Their empire. The Russians and the French had skin in the game to give to the British. The Germans have none. Point one. That's why we don't need to bring Germany in to explain these alliances. The British and the Russians and the French, they've been imperial power since the 16th century. Yes, they fight. They fight like cats and dogs. Almost go to war in the 1890s. But in the end, the British see that the French and the Russians have something concrete to give them. Okay, they make these alliances. These alliances are defensive, involve far-flung corners of the earth. What's wrong with that? Far-flung corners of the earth. The alliance would be... Go ahead, Alvin. That's absolutely correct. I hear a lot about you. Absolutely correct. The powers, the Russians and the French. The Russians and the British have no interest on the continent, not a lot, but the Russians and the French certainly do. It's to drive them forward on the continent. After they make these alliances, they're free to turn their backs on Asia, turn their backs on Africa, and concentrate on Europe. Russia, what area of the world is Russia going to concentrate on in Europe? What area in Europe is Russia going to concentrate on? The Balkans. Whose interests are threatened in the Balkans? Austria. Germany has no interest in the Balkans. Bismarck makes the famous statement, the Balkans aren't worth the bones of a Pomeranian grenadier. Austria's interests are threatened. Okay. So you look at that, the Fisher thesis, 1961, the famous book, Germany's Aims in the Grab at World Power, Germany's Aims in the First World War. All right, today we start the real thing. The First World War breaks out. It breaks out in August 1914. Breaks out in August 1914. It's going to go on for 4 long years. It is the great seminal Holocaust of the 20th century. The 48-month crucible, Europe's last summer. Want to begin? What questions should we ask about the First World War? What questions should we ask about this? Let's start off with these. One, what was the war? What was the war? Two, where was the war fought? Where was the war fought? Three, how was the war fought? How was the war fought? Four, I'll go over these again. By whom was it fought? By whom was it fought? With what was it paid? With what was it paid? Through what stages did it pass? What was the war? Where was it fought? How was it fought? By what? With what was it paid? With what was it paid? And through what stages did it pass? Through what stages did it pass? Let's take the last question first. The war goes through 4 stages. Stage 1, August 1914 to the middle of 1915. 2, the middle of 1915 to the end of 1916. 3, the year 1917. And 4, January to November 1918. 4 stages. Stage 1, August 1914 to the middle of 1915. Euphoria, joy and elation. Euphoria, joy and elation. Stage 2, the middle of 1915 to the end of 1916, depression, despondency, despair, the 3 Ds, depression, despondency, despair. Stage 3, the year 1917, the dawn of a new age, the dawn of a new age. Stage 4, January to November 1918, the end of an old world, the end of an old world. Stage 1, joy, elation, euphoria, August 1914 to the middle of 1915. Stage 2, stage of despondency, depression, despair, middle of 1915 to the end of 1916. Stage 3, the dawn of a new age, the year 1917. Stage 4, the end of an old world, January to November 1918. What was the war? Well, it's an affair of the great powers, point number one. An affair of the great powers. Only 2 small powers fight in the war initially. Only 2 small powers fight in the war initially, Belgium and Serbia. An affair of the great powers. Two. In the first phase, it's a struggle with nearly universal support. Peace groups are small, very small. Women, throws pedals at a soldier off, marching off to war. Peace groups are smart. There's a struggle with universal support. And a struggle in which the only aim is victory. The only aim at first is victory. An affair of the great powers, two small countries, Belgium and Serbia, the only two countries that participate. At first, two, after that, after a struggle with universal support, If the peace groups are small, then three, a struggle in which the only aim is victory. Now, that's not to say that the powers of Europe don't have war plans. We know the Germans have a war plan, the Schlieffen Plan. That collapses almost as soon as it's put to the test. The Germans have to race through Belgium. Whatever people foresee, in fact, happens. The emphasis is on speed as they race through Belgium. The Belgians blow up their bridges. They blocked their canals. They pick up guns and they shoot at the Germans. That's one surefire way of slowing down the German advance. The Germans must march 40 miles a day. By the time they get to France, they're exhausted. The plan has collapsed for another reason I'll go into in a minute. The French have a plan. I didn't tell you. Barbara Tuchman does, though. It's Plan D7. Plan 17. Why? Because it's the 17th plan the French have come up with. There are 16 plans before them. Plan 17 calls for the French. Go to the frontier. Jump out of railroad cars in their tight red pants and race towards the Germans with these long bayonets. The bayonets are supposed to, the sun on the bayonets gleam in the eyes of the Germans, blind the Germans while the French stab them to death and they bleed. But it doesn't work out that way. The German guns are too heavy for the French bayonets and the French fall back. So that plan is discredited. The Schlieffen Plan is discredited. So it's a war. What is the war? An affair of great powers, struggle with nearly universal support. Victory's the only aim. The powers do have plans. The Schlieffen Plan. Plan 17, but they collapse. It's also a war. What is the war? It's a war of words. A war of words. Propaganda enters into the war in a way never seen before. In a way never seen, but the propaganda on both sides, the German will call and the Allied side, is remarkably similar. They paint the enemy as wicked, as evil, as the devil incarnate. Wicked, evil, the devil incarnate. Devil incarnate. And they say, the forces of good will sweep forward unimpeded once the enemy is defeated. Defeat the enemy and everything good is possible. The enemy represents blackness. The enemy represents all evil, darkness. This prop goes on for 4 years. The effect of the propaganda is that the governments are very good at waging it. The United States very effectively when it gets in. The effect is to make the peoples of Europe hate each other. So when the war is over, this propaganda that's been pumped into their heads for 4 years is not easily forgotten. Propaganda probably reaches its most stunning phase, and I'm going to jump ahead of chronology, when the British government in 1917, December 1917, issues a proclamation. It's called the Balfour Declaration. Balfour is the foreign secretary of the British government. Balfour so says, the British government, His Majesty's government, henceforth associates themselves with the Jews, and henceforth associates themselves with a Jewish state in the middle of Palestine. The Balfour Declaration, basically a propaganda device. Says the British government associates themselves with Jews. Jews should have a homeland in Palestine, in parallel Palestine. There are practical motives which enter into the Balfour Doctrine, Balfour Declaration. The British government thinks the Germans are going to do the same thing. They want to get ahead of the Germans. They issued this Balfour Declaration. And to the British government is tight for money. They think the Jews have a lot of it. And money will flow into London as a result of this declaration that they make. Balfour Declaration, December of 1917. The man is the foreign secretary and the British foreign secretary. He said, His Majesty's government associate themselves with the hope, the aspirations of the Jews. Jews throughout the world to have a homeland in Palestine. Done to get ahead of the Germans, too. Done as well to get money, they think, from Jews that are wealthy. The Balfour Declaration, and we see this is the first manifestation of the State of Israel, which will come into being in 1940. It goes back. Precursor is the Balfour Declaration of December 1917. Okay, let's talk a little bit about where was the war fought? It was fought on land and sea. Fought on land and sea. In the west, fought on land and sea. In the east, it's fought in Poland, the German part of Poland called Posen, in the east. In the west, it's fought on the land and also at sea. On the land, it's fought in northeastern France. And the warfare in northeastern France is trench warfare. It's going to go on the Western Front for 4 long years, trench warfare. Trench warfare. What are the trenches? They're ditches. Characteristic of these ditches, they're very deep. They're very deep. They're cold. They're wet. They stink. They're full of rats and lice. And they are only yards away from enemy lines. Only yards away from enemy lines. What happens is something like this. How is it fought, the trench warfare? At a snail's pace. What happens in a typical day, typical trench, that the men would go out, they would blacken their faces at night. They would go out and try to take enemy prisoners, try to take other prisoners and bring them down into the trenches. They would interrogate these men with varying degrees of success because the powers involved, the Germans and the French, the British are coming in big time, but not quite yet. The powers involved, the Germans don't speak good French and the French don't speak good German, but it's still what they're going to do. They blacken their faces at night. They take prisoners, bring them down into these dark holes, cold, wet, deep, stink, rats and lice, and they interrogate them. Morning comes. A blast of fire and the men jump out of the trenches. They race toward the enemy lines. They release poison gas. The goal is speed. The goal is kill the enemy. The strategy backfires. One, the bombardments, they're not long enough. The bombardments aren't long enough. Two, the men, they don't run fast enough. Three, the elements, they're not kind enough. The soil is deep. The wind is strong. And the gas blows back in the faces of the men who released it. So the war is fought. It's fought at a snail's pace. Bombardments, they're not long enough. Not long. The men, they don't run fast enough. The elements are not kind enough. The gas blows back in the faces of the men. Of the men who release it, so it's fought on land in northeastern France. It's also fought on the west. It's fought at sea, and this is caused by a decision early in the war of the British. The British blockade the northern coast of Germany, the English Channel, the North Sea, blockaded by the British. The blockade
The blockade is very, very effective. Very effective indeed. Very effective. The Germans try to send ships into the North Sea, and they win a battle against the British. They win a battle, but the problem is the Germans don't have as many ships as the British. The British, the ships keep coming. The Germans decide to try another way. They decide to try another way. They declare a blockade of the British Isles. Blockade of the British Isles. And they mean to enforce this blockade with a new weapon. They mean to enforce this blockade with a weapon at which they excel. I don't know whether they invented it or not, but they know the weapon is the submarine. The submarine. The submarine, the German submarine have. Unfortunately, the German submarines don't have periscopes that are very narrow. Periscopes that are very narrow. They cannot see very well, but they're very deadly in what they do. They sink ships and ships and ships. They sink not only in British ships, they sink neutral ships, one of which carries 1,200 Americans. 1,200 Americans die at sea, the Lusitania, May of 1915. The Americans don't like this at all. They don't like this at all. The President of the United States, we'll talk about him on Wednesday. Name is Woodrow Wilson. The Germans think he's pro-British all along, and he is. He protests strongly. The Americans and other powers quote a law to the Germans. The law of blockades. Law of blockade says this: in order for a blockade to be legal, a shot must be fired. Fired across the bow of a ship. A shot must be fired across the bow of a ship. After that occurs, the shot is fired, the crew, the warship, the people on the warship, the soldiers, the sailors can go and take cargo from the ship. Three, after they take cargo from the ship, they've got to make provisions for the safety of the crew. Now, what on earth am I talking about? That's the law. That's the law of blockades. That law was written, passed in the year 1856. And there were no submarines in the year 1856. But the Germans are afraid of the Americans coming in. Afraid of Wilson. So they decide in 1915, to call off unrestricted submarine warfare and concentrate only on enemy ships. It's no holds barred. They call this off unrestricted submarine warfare in 1915. For a time, they're going to resume it later on with devastating consequences. In the meantime, so we have the war in the West. Trench warfare, war at sea, trench warfare fought on the land, fought at a snail's pace. In the East, it's entirely different. It's caused in the East, the war is fought at a gallop, and this is because of two things: the Russian mobilization, which the Schlieffen Plan envisaged, required, demanded be slowed, didn't live up to those expectations. It's quick, it's fast. And the Russians throw 1 million men into Germany, the Polish part of Germany. In the meantime, the Schlieffen Plan has collapsed. So four divisions of the German army have to march across Europe to confront the invading Russians. 1 million men thrown into Germany by the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, August 1914. The German army, rushes from Belgium to try to meet this invasion. This Russian army of 1 million men is a paper tiger. No training at all. Hideously trained. One, logistical support virtually non-existent. Logistical support. No nurses. No field kitchens. No first aid kits. No artillery. No nurses, no field kitchens, no first aid kits, no artillery. The generals, two commanding generals, hate each other, don't talk to each other. Making matters worse, the generals, the officers send messages, but their messages aren't encrypted. And guess what? The messages fall into the hands of the Germans. The Germans learn that the Russians are planning to split their two armies. The Germans take advantage and they encircle the Russians. The biggest German victory of the war, 29 August 1914 at the Battle of Tannenberg. 100,000 Germans are taken, Russians are taken prisoner. The morale of the Russian army is shattered. The victory at Tannenberg has some very important consequences. Two generals are the heroes of Tannenberg. One is Paul von Hindenburg. The other is Erich Ludendorff. Notice I don't say Erich von Ludendorff. Ludendorff is not aristocratic. Ludendorff comes up basically from the middle class. Ludendorff and Hindenburg, heroes of the battle in Tannenberg. Rapidly become rock stars in Germany. They eclipse the politicians. They begin to eclipse Bethmann Hollweg, the chancellor. They begin to eclipse William II, who's gone back to his old ways after being a statesman, and rapidly become the real decision maker. So Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the victors of Tannenberg, become heroes in Germany. The men who basically are going to make the real decisions. Now there is. The Russian morale is devastated. The Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, believes that it's his duty to come from the cat and place himself at the head of the Russian troops fighting the war. Come out, come from St. Peter. Come to the front and take command of the Russian army. This is a terrible blunder. Why? One, no one in St. Petersburg is minding the store. Two, the fate of Nicholas, always, problematic. The fate of Nicholas now will be bound inextricably with the performance of the Russian armies at the front. Bound by the performance of the Russian armies at the front. The Germans, this great victory they win. Hindenburg, Ludendorff become heroes overnight. They overshadow the politicians. Nicholas II comes to the front, takes command of the Russian troops. No one is left in St. Petersburg to watch after how things are going. And Nicholas has got enemies. And now Nicholas's fate is tied to the fate of the Russian armies. Well, the Germans, this great victory has a downside to it. The Russians, at the time, they're fighting Tannenberg, also throw men against Austria-Hungary. Austria and Serbia and Galicia. The Austrians are desperate. They want the Germans to come and help them, but the Germans don't send any troops. The result is that the Austrians are defeated in the summer, in the autumn of 1914, by the Russians and the Serbs. The flower of the Austrian, officer corps, is devastated by this defeat at the hands of the Serbs and the Russians. And the Austrians begin to think, maybe we were wrong to have started this war in the first place. Maybe this allied, use it or lose it, now we're getting a new demonstration. Here we need help, and they don't send it to us. They're defeated.
the Austrians in the end of 1914. But 1915, the war becomes worldwide. Other powers enter the war in 1915. Four countries. One, Australia. Australia's not a power, obviously, not a country either. It's a British dominion. But the Aussies come to Europe from far away in 1915. Even before that, another power enters the war. This power is Japan. Japan comes into the war in late 1914 on the side of the British, on the side of the French and the Russians. The Japanese have their eyes on colonies the Germans have in the Pacific, not worth too much, but the Japanese think they are. They've got their eyes on colonies the Germans have in the Pacific. The Japanese want to assert themselves as a power by performing well on the seas, and they do that. At the end of the war, Japan will have emerged as a new player on the world stage. They've been forgotten about since they defeated Russia in 1904, but they're going to perform very well in the First World War, lose no battles, perform very well at sea, and have something to say about the post-war world. Another power, even more important, comes into the war in 1915 with a number of the very important consequences. This power is the Ottoman Empire. Turkey. Ottoman Empire enters the war in 1915 on the side of the Germans and the Austrians, or the Germans, on the side of the Central Powers. Why? Some people say the Germans have extensive economic interests in Turkey, but the British have extensive economic interests in Turkey. Probably the Turks come in. The Turks come in because they're tired of being bullied by the Russians. This Turkish decision to enter the war has worldwide consequences, strategical consequences, military consequences, political consequences, moral consequences. Strategical consequences. It forces the Allies to divert their troops from Europe to the Suez Canal in the Near East. One, strategic. Strategical, it prevents the Greeks and the Romanians from entering the war when they want to. The Romanians are going to come in, but not now. It delays the entry of the Romanians and Greeks into the war. It separates Russia from the other powers, the Western powers. So strategically, it's vitally significant. That diverts the strength of the Allied powers from Europe to the Suez Canal. Two, Romania delays the entrance into the war of Romania and Greece. Three, it separates Russia from the Western powers. Strategic, military. Some British, are tired of fighting in France. They think the time has come. The time has come to link up with the Russians. They can't do it now that Turkey has entered the war. The only way they can do it is for the British Navy to break through the straits, enter the Black Sea, and hook up with the Russians, bring aid to the Russians, take some pressure off the Russians. And that is the strategy that's adopted. The British want to force the straits. They want to force the straits. They want to come to the Black Sea. Then they want to give aid. Soldiers joining link the Russian army with the British army. Take some pressure off the Russians. Problem, the plan doesn't work. The Turks are very good. The straits are mined the bottom of the straits. Landmines. The Turks have guns on both sides of the straits. The British, as the ships come into the strait, are blown up. They're shattered. They're pummeled by guns. They're blown up by landmines at the Battle of Gallipoli. And this is a stain on the reputation
of the first Lord of the Admiralty, whose strategy this was. His name is Winston Churchill. Churchill's plan to force the Straits, link up with the Russians by sea. Nothing comes of it. It's devastated by the performance of the Ottoman Turks. They mine the Straits, and they have guns on both sides. Both sides. They blow the British ship out of the water, literally at the Battle of Gallipoli. Political consequences. The British are not going to take this lying down. The British aim to get back at the Turks by making a deal with a group that lives under them. The Arabs live under the Turks. The British make a deal with the Arabs. They say, you cause trouble for the Turks. Rise up against the Turks, and we'll support Arab independence after the war is over. You can see a new theater emerging. The Middle East. They make a deal with the Arab. You support. You stir up in the Red Sea. Rebel against the Ottoman Turks. And we'll support you at the peace. The people support Arab independence. Moral consequences. The British turn around and make a deal with the French, canceling what they said to the Arabs. They're going to divide the Arab world. They're going to the spoils of the Ottoman Empire between themselves. Between themselves, after making this public commitment to the Arab, that they're going to support Arab independence. They turn around and make a deal with the French, dividing up the Ottoman Empire, which they want to break up like the Habsburg monarchy, by the way. Moral consequences as well. The Turks move through the Balkans. The Turks encounter resistance from a group, the Armenians. The Armenians are Christian, they're not Muslim. The Turks think the Armenians harbor allied sentiments and they're slowing down their advance. The Turks decide to take matters into their own hands to get rid of the Armenians. The Armenians are burned. They're poisoned. They're drowned. They're hanged. A new word enters the vocabulary. We don't know how many there were. I read on Google this morning at least 650,000. Estimations run as high as 1,500,000. My colleague, Professor Margaret Anderson, could tell us more about that. That's her specialty. The new word, genocide. The Armenian genocide practiced by the Turks against the Armenians in the year 1915. Extermination, poison, drowned, burnt, shot. At least 650,000. Moral stain. The British, moral stain. They promised the Arabs independence. And then they make a deal with the French, canceling what they say. Political. This deal. Military, the British, they try to force the Straits. The Turks have the Straits lined with mines and manpower, guns on both sides of the Straits, and the British are blown out of the water. Strategic! Forces the Allies to divert attention to Europe. Delays the entry into the war of the Romanians and the Greeks, the Romanians mainly. Cuts Russia off from the northern powers. That's not all. One other power enters the war in the year 1915. At long last, after much careful consideration, Italy comes into the war 1915 on the side of the Allied powers. The Treaty of London signed in 1915 between the British, I'm sorry, the Italians, and the Allied powers. But the Italians are promised territory on the Adriatic that they've wanted all along. Territory on the Adriatic Sea that they've wanted all along. They enter the war on the side of the Allied powers. This is the result. This decision does not come easily to the Italians. There are two groups in Italy. One group is called the Neutralists. The Neutralists are Catholic. They don't want to fight against Catholic Austria. On the other side, more numerous are the Interventionists. They want to enter the war on the side of the Allied powers. The interventionists. The intervention. Who are the interventionists? The king. Politicians. Journalists. One journalist is a particularly strong advocate of intervention. His name is Benito Mussolini. A little bit about Benito Mussolini. Mussolini's number was a journalist, politically. Mussolini, born in the year 1883. Born in the year 1883. Politically, Mussolini is all over the map. He starts out as a socialist. Gradually, he becomes an ardent champion of Italian nationalism. He becomes an interventionist, advocating intervention. Mussolini is a talented writer. He writes books in beautiful Italian. A talented writer has written novels in beautiful, beautiful Italian. Mussolini is also a philanderer, chases after every woman who comes in sight. If Prince of can't keep his pants up, Mussolini cannot keep his on. There's some horrifying consequences. Mussolini's also a theorist. Mussolini is invents a political doctrine. The doctrine is called fascism. Fascism, basic. Whether Mussolini invents it or not, I don't know, but he's the most prominent advocate of it. What is fascism? Comes from a Latin word, rods in a bundle of acts. Fascism, it's also very simply explained. Unlike Marxism, Nazism, Mussolini writes an article for an encyclopedia in 1932. In 1932, he explains exactly what fascism is. It means two distinct things. One, it means the glorification of the leader of the state. Glorification of the leader of the state. The leader of the state embodies all the virtues of the people and so should not be questioned. Amounts basically of someone who should be worshipped. Two, the most important thing about fascism is what it has to say about war. War is not something to be afraid of. War is not something to be avoided. War is not death. It's not bloodshed. It's not wounds. Not suffering. War is an exercise in heroism, bravery, valor. All the human virtues, the great virtues are exhibited in war. Valor, bravery, heroism, sacrifice. Not something to be shunned. Something to engage in. A romance. Mussolini, founder of Italian fascism, primary advocate of Italy's entrance into the war. Italy comes into the war in the year 1915. Italy's entrance into the war does the Allies little good. By 1915, the middle of 1915, a new mood comes over the populations. All the populations of Europe. They want to get the war over with. There are two ways to get the war over with. One, way one, wage the war more energetically, prosecute it more vigorously, more ardently than ever before. Wage it more soldiers, more guns. And people who take this view want more weapons at the front. The British come forward with a new weapon. New kind of tractors that carry machine guns on them. Also airplanes, submarines, tanks, ways to win the war. Get it over with faster. More men, more guns. Better use of skills. Another way to end the war. End the war by appealing to the existing standards of European civilization. appeal to the existing standards of European civilization and end the war. The peace groups start to form, get in touch with each other. They want to end the war by appealing to the existing standards of civilization. The other way is to end the war by repudiating the existing standards of civilization in the name of a new one. Someone named Lenin advocates that. More on that, more on Lenin in a minute, in a little while, next time. So there's two ways to end this war. But in the meantime, 1916 is a terrible winter, terrible winter. And new methods are adopted. New methods are adopted in all the countries concerned. What methods? Price controls, rationing, censorship. Price controls, rationing, censorship, and the use of women, bringing women to the front, more on which later. Rationing, price controls, censorship, making use of women at the front. New men come to power. David Lloyd George in Great Britain, Georges Clemenceau in France, vowing to fight the war to the finish. Bateman Holdig is still hanging on by his fingertips, but day by day, Bateman is becoming less and less relevant, less and less overshadowed by the generals, by Hindenburg and Ludendorff, overshadowed. New ways to end the war. New men, new ways. These methods do not work. The rationing, the price controls, the censorship. Why? Number of reasons. The people in charge do not have proper statistics. People in charge do not have the right statistics, do not have proper statistics. The targets, they aim at targets hit and miss. They aim at targets hit and miss. Often the people themselves, the people in charge are split on what decisions to make. Statistics, bad statistics, targets, hit and miss. The result in every country, a growth in peace sentiment. Growth in peace sentiment. Peace movements grow. Riots break out. Mutinies occur. Especially is this true in the case of the French. Mutinies, riots break out, mutinies, demonstrations, because the methods do not work, the methods chosen. Let's take a look at some of the methods that are chosen. In July 1916, there is a famous conference that meets in Paris. The Allied powers meet in Paris at this conference, July 1916. What they decide, number one, they're going to pull their resources together. There's going to be, they say, a single board controlling the currencies of all the Allied powers. They're going to divide the world into economies economies controlled by themselves. They're going to divide the world into markets controlled by themselves. Divide the world. They're going to have tariffs. They're going to pull their resources, and their currency controlled by a single board, the state intervening in life. Oh, you bet. This means, if they get their way, this will destroy the economy of Germany. Destroy the economy of Germany. The Paris Conference of July 1916. The Paris Conference aims at pulling resources together. One, having tariffs. A board controlling the currency of the powers concerned, and dividing the world, sharing the world out, into region, into market economies, which will mean the destruction of the Germans and their economy. Talk about the Fisher thesis. There is something that refutes it. The aims in the First World War, that aim is gargantuan. There's also problems in Germany in 1915, 1916. The Germans faced four major problems. One is how to finance the war. War credits. Two, constitutional reform. Three, a statement of war aims. It's very important now for the Germans to formulate their war aims because they're afraid of the Social Democrats. So let's talk about these problems. In the beginning, getting war credits, getting money for the war was pretty easy because the Social Democrats, the largest party in the Reichstag, went along with it. The enemy, after all, was autocratic, reactionary, despotic Russia. But as the war goes on, the Social Democrats are less inclined to grant war credits. The Germans cannot borrow money like some of the Allied powers can from the United States. So they solve this problem. How do they pay for the war? They can't tax, they can't borrow, but they sure can print. And they begin to print money. They begin to print money to finance the war. They begin to print money to finance the war. Closely related to this, constitutional reform, the goal is to do something about this hideously antiquated constitution and replace it with something more modern. The goal basically is to turn the Reichstag into a parliament similar to that which exists in Great Britain. The government takes steps along these lines. In 1917, the Emperor William II promises he's going to do away with the existing system of voting that exists, the system that exists in Germany. But along, he goes slowly. It's called his Easter message of 1917. He goes slowly. His heart is not in it. As a result, strikes increase. As a result, demonstrations increase. 55,000 men are arrested in Berlin in 1915. As a result, the parties, the Social Democrats, the largest party in the Reich, begin split. Independent Social Democrats who want to oppose the government vigorously and Social Democrats who basically take a more moderate stance. The independent Social Democrats themselves split. There is a militant wing of the independent Social Democrats. They form the Spartacus League. The Spartacus League, the leader is a woman whose name is Rosa Luxemburg. The belief of the Spartacus League is that Germany is ripe for revolution. Germany ripe for revolution. The Spartacus League of 1917 coming into being. How to pay for the war. The Social Democrats don't want to give any more money for the war. They're tired. The government can't tax, it can't borrow, so it begins to print money. The idea behind constitutional reform. The Germans are asked to make sacrifices. Sacrifices at home, or on the front. All this should be met by reform at home. What they want is to change the Reichstag into a parliament, like the one that exists in Great Britain. The government drags its feet. However, in 1917, William goes this far. He says, I'll abolish the existing voting system in Germany, in the States.
the existing voting, the system which exists in the states, in the various states of Germany. Germany, like the United States, is comprised of states. He'll abolish this voting system. He doesn't follow through. In the meantime, strikes, demonstration. 55,000 men arrested in 1915. 55,000 men arrested in the year 1915. And the Germans, people in Germany, a league, the Spartacus League, saying the time has come, not for and talk of reform, the time has come for revolution. Germany is ripe for revolution, led by a woman whose name is Rosa Luxemburg. Also very important in Germany's a statement of war aims. What is it the Germans are fighting for? They think the statement of war aims, clarifying what their intentions are, will make things easier with the opposition parties in the Reichstag. There are two groups in the statement of war aims. Two groups. One, the annexationists. They want to annex all the territory around Germany and restore authority at home. Annex Belgium, annex Poland, annex the Baltic states. Tie them to Germany. They are opposed, not opposed. And who are the leaders in this annexation movement? One, the big industrialists. Two, the great military leagues, Hindenburg, Ludendorff, and three, intellectuals, university professors, history professors most of all. They sign a petition in 1915, the intellectual Eingabe. Petition of the intellectuals, they call for annexation of the states surrounding Belgium, the Baltic states, Poland. They say, what? Germany needs this to defend herself, defend her territories. And two, Germany has a mission to civilize the Slavs. The petition of the intellectuals, July 1915. In university, some of the most famous historians in the Reichsgründung have signed this petition. Lamprecht, Droyce, very famous historian, it goes to the government. They call for outright annexation of the states around Germany. Outright annexation of the states surrounding Germany. Tying to the Reich. Opposed to this group is a more moderate faction led by the Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg. Professor Keillor will tell you something different. Bethmann Hollweg, Bethmann Hollweg sees the states around Germany, not something to be annexed, but a loose federation dominated by Germany, but not annexed to Germany. Bethmann Hollweg comes up with a plan in September 1914 called the September Program, in which he advocates just this. Now, this September Program was adopted at a time of great optimism. It is not something Bethmann sticks to during the war. He changes, he's flexible. He does not want outright annexation. He wants of the territories surrounding Germany. That is basically what this is all about. What are we going to do with the territories that surround us? Not France, who's a great power, but Belgium, Poland, the Baltic states. Annex, no. Loosely federated state. Laid down in the September program. It is more moderate than the annexationist program. More moderate than... Who's opposed to this? Opposed to this are the generals on the right... and the social democrats on the left. So Bethmann gets the worst of both worlds. Condemned by Ludendorff and him not going far enough. Condemned by the social democrats going too far.
The moderate answer to the annexationist aim. You get a different version from Professor Keeler. You can take that up in your discussion section. Okay? Economically, the Germans have a problem. Problem can be best stated, was summarized by Gordon Craig, a very famous professor of history at Stanford University, friend of your author, got me a job at Berkeley. He died in 2005, the grand old man of German history, Gordon A. Craig. What it's worth. The problem, said the Germans face, according to Gordon Craig, very eloquently, how to survive in a protracted war, a war that was thought to be short, against a coalition that has superior resources and command of the seas. How to survive in a protracted conflict with Schlieffen and everybody else. Barbara Tuchman said, the home when the leaves fall. That's true. It was going to be short against a coalition who had superior resources and command of the seas. Two problems plagued the Germans very much. What is the problem of munitions? The problem of munitions. The other is the problem of manpower and soldiers. Munitions, the stuff that they put in the guns. Munitions dry up on the Western Front. By the end of 1914, they're all out of them. What are they going to do? The Germans set up a raw material section of the war ministry. I'm not sure whether it's the war ministry or the government. A raw material section under the command of a man whose name is Walter Rathenau. You don't need to remember that. A Jew is going to lose his life. Maybe we'll talk about him later on, but not now. Okay, the raw material. The raw material section does a couple things. It takes a survey of all the raw materials in Germany. It buys them up, and begins to try to address this problem of munitions. And it does something else, uses a process Patrick can tell us about, nitrogen fixation. Professor Coffey, you can give the rest of this lecture. Nitrogen fixation, don't ask me what it is, it enables the Germans to change these raw materials into munitions. It's a revolution. What's the process? The Fritz.
Synthesis of ammonia from atmosphere.
Is there the Fritz Haber process? Okay, nitrogen, thank you very much. This man's written a book on this subject. Okay, so the nitrogen used to turn raw material into weapons. There's a problem of manpower, and here we have the industrialists. The industrialists against the military men. The industrialists want skilled labor at home to make these new munitions. The military says no, skilled labor belongs at the front to fight the French and the British. The Germans adopt a compromise. The skilled labor is sent to the front. Unskilled labor is trained to become skilled. Big deal. To make munitions. Not only that, the places of men are quickly taken up by women. Women become one of the principal makers of munitions. Women come into the workforce in Germany and the other states, but Germany most of all, in a way not seen before. Obviously, this is going to shake the fiber of society. How deeply is an open question. But it does obviously have questions, because women are seen in a role they've never assumed before. Well, now, this period of discontent, these new methods that are adopted, rationing, price controls, censorship does not really work. Also, by the end of 1916, the plight of His Majesty, the Tsar of Russia. The Tsar of Russia is one that's become absolutely desperate.
Nicholas, remember, has gone to the front. Nicholas has gone to the front. He did that after the Battle of Tannenberg. He went to the front to take command of the Russian army because he thought he could lead it better. The Tsar at the front, the Tsar, the symbol of Holy Russia at the front, leading the troops would have an electrifying effect. A blunder, no one is left. See what goes on in St. Petersburg. His fate is tied to the fate of the Russian army. Well, the Russian armies do not perform well. There is strikes, and demonstrations in St. Petersburg. There are calls for Nicholas to abdicate. Nicholas says no until he's pulled off a train one night by his generals, the Yanushkeviches, who support the autocracy, say, "Your Majesty, guess what? Things would be better off if you weren't around. Go." And Nicholas, decisive as ever, goes. Advocates just like that. Incredible. The pillars of Russia, of old Russia, the military men are the when to say to the pillar of the state, go, get out of here. Things will be better off without you. Nicholas adds, and there is a revolution in Russia. February 1917, called the February Revolution. The February Revolution. New men come to power. They promise reforms. The Allies are overjoyed. New men come to power. They promise reform. The Allies could not be happier. Now Russia is once, now autocratic, reactionary Russia has become a liberal democracy. There are fresh faces. There's reform. However, the government makes a crucial mistake, I guess. The government is determined to wage the war more energetically than ever before. And they do no better at it, even worse, than the Tsar did. So there's discontent everywhere. In the beginning of end of 1916, the beginning of 1917. End of 1916, the Austrians feel we've had enough. In 1916, the Emperor of Austria, Francis Joseph, dies. The man is 88 years old. He's succeeded by his grandnephew, Charles. The ministers say it's time for Austria to get out of the war. Time for Austria to get out of this war before the war ruins us, takes us down. They make an offer to the Allies. Guess what they offer? They'll let the French keep Alsace and Lorraine. One. Belgium. They'll let Belgium restore Belgium the way it was before the Germans invade. And the Serbs, they can have whatever they want, believe it or not. The Serbs, basically a peace almost at any price, but allow the monarchy to survive. The Allies turn this offer down. One, the Italians, for some, have influence with the Allies because they're waging battles right now that are important. They don't want the Austrians out unless the Austrians give them territory. More importantly, the British and the French, but the British mainly, have developed an aim, a post-war aim, like the Ottoman Empire, which is going to be broken up. The Habsburg monarchy will be broken up as well. There will be an Austria, yes. There will be a Hungary, yes, but not Austria-Hungary. There will be a Poland and a state, Czech state. There'll be a Yugoslav, so they turn down the Austrians cold. The Austrian peace offer is rejected in 1917. In the meantime, things get interesting for the Germans and the Russians. The Russians are entered prosecuting this war more energetically than ever before. The Russians, but they're doing the war. The war's going terribly for the Russians. The Russians are being slaughtered. One man wants to end this war and end it quickly. This man happens to be in Switzerland. Problem for the Germans, get this man out of Switzerland, back to Russia as fast as possible. Beginning of 1917. The Germans put Vladimir Lenin in a boxcar, travels across Europe, and arrives at the Finland station in Russia in 1917. We'll pick up the story there next.